Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey. You're listening to Reality Check Radio as always. Another interesting week, as every week has been, I think, since we've been doing it. We've been very lucky to have interesting weeks. Welcome back, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to join you again.
So the first bit of international news that I'd like to go into would be Trump's return to Twitter, or X, and the conversation that he had with Elon Musk. Not so much an interview, I think, as some people in the media were saying it was an interview, but Elon was very forthright that it was a conversation, and it was quite a lengthy conversation, actually, between two to three hours, I think a solid 2.5 hours. And I just brought it up briefly when I was talking to Nathan earlier as well, and I was sort of bringing it up in the context of Trump bypassing the media and speaking to people directly. But I think we can speak about the broader impact on the campaign, on the US election this is having as well. And perhaps that, is this conversation sort of dealing with people's concerns about the Trump campaign? Because there is some concern I can see from people on the right wing that they're worried his campaign is flagging a bit, that he's not focused. And what do you think this conversation did to kind of assuage those fears?
Well, I think the first thing that's notable is the huge reach that conversation had. It reached huge numbers of people, and I can't remember the exact figures off the top of my head. But yeah, incredible reach. He spoke for a long time. He got to speak directly to a lot of people who are listening in rather than being filtered through the media, as you've said. And it harkened back a little bit, just a little bit, to Trump's 2016 campaign. And the dynamic in 2016 was different because there was more censorship. There was more political correctness, had a greater hold on the national political debate and the national conversation. And Trump was this sort of insurgent candidate who did these outrageous tweets. His ability on Twitter was a huge part of his success in 2016. And of course, he hasn't been on Twitter during the campaign so far. He's been using his own social media platform, Truth Social. And so a lot of the complaints, some of the complaints that from the likes of Nick Fuentes, for example, around Trump's campaign, that he hasn't recaptured that energy of 2016, that his campaign is sort of too mainstream. And so this groper war has been launched against them to try and take on the mainstream elements that have supposedly captured his campaign and get him back to his incisive countercultural meme war type style campaign that he waged on Twitter the last time. So I think there is something to that. There was a very unique energy in the 2016 campaign, and it came largely from his Twitter, like we said. But the dynamic is different this time because the issues that Trump raised, he was groundbreaking in that he raised them in a major presidential campaign. And the effect of that on the conversation and him allowing people to talk about those issues, bringing them into the mainstream, was a big factor. But now the conversation nationally is loosened up a bit more. I don't know whether Trump can have the same sort of invigorating effect on the political debate that he had last time. But still, it would be good to see him back on Twitter and back to some of his old habits. It certainly was entertaining and kept the campaign interesting.
I think it's a good point that you're making about how constrained the conversation was back in 2016. And then the censorship was increased after he won. And in 2020, it was even much worse. And people have also forgotten, like, 4 years have passed since 2020, 8 years have passed since 2016. People, I think, have forgotten that the conversations that are now being had in the open here on the radio, all over various different social media groups and platforms that people actually have, in a strange way, much more freedom of speech and much more an ability to talk about what used to be sort of considered to be very fringe and forbidden subjects. There, you know, that and Trump was the one who brought those into the mainstream. He can't do that again. He can't bring the things back into the mainstream that he already brought into the mainstream.
No, he would have to go for new topics, new and perhaps even more controversial topics. That's the question. Is he willing to go to some of those places, some of those new topics, and what would they be?
Yeah, and it could be dangerous too in terms of winning voters that he needs, right? It's an election. There's certain key voters, key demographics and swing states. We talked about those last week that he needs to win. It may just not be the most useful thing for him to be the edgiest person in the room all the time. I think we'll see how his campaign develops in these last 90 days. And hopefully his return to Twitter is permanent, that he actually posts and interacts with people on there. And that he has a bit more of a direct connection with his voters. He's obviously planning to go back to Butler as well soon, where the attempted assassination took place. And there's a lot of energy there around that. He focused on that in his conversation with Elon Musk as well quite a bit early on. The attempted assassination, and you think about that was a month ago. Not really that long ago in the grand scheme of things. And so many things have changed in the campaign since then. Even this week, we may briefly touch on the fact that Kamala Harris's VP pick, who we talked about last week, Tim Walz, has sort of been embroiled in a bit of a stolen valor controversy, where he had previously claimed to have a rank that he didn't actually achieve. He had a slightly lower rank in the state National Guard that he was serving in. He dodged his deployment to Iraq. He resigned from his unit just several months before they were deployed. So that's it's got a bit of a, leaving a bit of a bitter taste in the mouths of many veterans in America. Obviously, military issues are very, very important there. And to have a guy who kind of, embellished his military career a little bit, running, as vice president, is hurting Kamala Harris in a small way, at least with Trump's base. And the fact that neither of them have done interviews. Talking here about Trump going on late night with Elon Musk for nearly 3 hours. You can't get Kamala Harris and Tim Walz away from their canned speeches that they give, the teleprompter speeches. That's it. And there's no real coverage from the media on that. Journalists aren't actually pushing them. I feel like there's one solid interview. I said this to Nathan just before, one interview with the mainstream media and they could completely annihilate her campaign. Like, she could perform that badly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Biden has to use the teleprompter because he's senile and he forgets where he is and what he's supposed to be saying. But Kamala isn't senile. It's just that when she's speaking sort of off the cuff, she says these really inane things. So she needs the constant guidance of the speechwriters and whoever else to sort of keep her on track.
And now we can quickly pop into the United Kingdom again. Things have calmed down a little bit in the United Kingdom, although two-tier Keir's popularity has suffered quite a big hit. He does seem to have calmed things down at a cost to his credibility. He's putting a lot of people in jail for speech crimes, thought crimes, saying things on the internet. But before we get into that, we did have one bit of feedback that came back after the last show, and I'll just read that out now. Someone writes in here, "I listened to Dewa and William discussing the Southport stabbing. A comment was made that the attacker slash murderer was an immigrant who probably shouldn't be there. But the fact that the boy was a 17-year-old born in Wales to a Christian family. His parents were immigrants or refugees from Rwanda. The boy himself was not an immigrant. I imagine the family fled the Rwandan genocide. It was people jumping to the conclusion that he was a Muslim immigrant that in part, at least in part, triggered the violent response. And that simply wasn't true." So thank you for that bit of feedback there. I think it was me that said that he was an immigrant, and I kind of moved past that. And I actually thought at the time, I thought, oh, maybe I should clarify the issue around him having been a second generation immigrant, the issue with assimilation and integration, like, because this was an initial bit of pushback as well, saying, oh no, he was Welsh. It was a Welshman who did the attack. But clearly, that's not the case, right? He doesn't see himself as a Welshman. He doesn't see himself as British. This boy viewed himself as a foreigner. He viewed himself as a Rwandan, perhaps. He specifically targeted, like it was a racially motivated attack. He targeted English girls. I guess this is a good point to clarify in the broader conversation, and I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts on this. Like, what has gone wrong with immigration, with integration, with assimilation, and why do we actually see perhaps first-generation immigrants that, like, try to fit in, and then second-generation immigrants sort of revert to an identity crisis? And it seems like a lot of these attacks are often actually done by, say, second-generation immigrants.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the point that I think we were discussing, or that I was discussing at that point in the conversation, was that, large numbers of immigrants have been brought in. They haven't assimilated well. That there's it's created sort of hostility, racial conflict, racial strife in the community, and that has precipitated the protests. And whether the 17-year-old kid who committed the murders was an immigrant himself, or the child of immigrants, is really beside the point a little bit. You know, he's an immigrant in the sense that he's a second-generation immigrant, or he's a member of an immigrant community. But yeah, he's not an immigrant in the sense that he immigrated himself. But that's kind of irrelevant. I think the point, the main point sort of stands that as I said, large numbers of people have come in. It's created ethnic hostility, and that's why people are protesting. And it's a bad policy that ought to be stopped, and measures taken to try and sort it out. The question of why people haven't assimilated, I guess we used to have a model of immigration, an assimilationist model, where we explicitly tried to assimilate people into the community. And we had much smaller rates of immigration as well. And then at some point in the preceding decades, we changed that model of immigration from an assimilationist approach to a sort of multicultural salad bowl approach, where people were allowed to come in and keep their own culture. It was thought of as a sort of a racist or supremacist, or kind of similar to like a colonialist or oppressive, to force your culture onto these immigrant groups. And so we had this multicultural salad bowl approach, but that approach has proven to be much worse than the earlier assimilationist approach. It's created ethnic strife and conflict. You've got these competing communities with different values and interests. They butt heads. It's going into the political process now with, for example, Muslims in Britain doing like block voting along ethnic or ethno-religious lines. I think we can say that the multicultural salad bowl approach to immigration is a failure. And I think this idea of racism has a lot to do with it. Racism in most circumstances is bad. You don't want to be being mean or treating people unfairly on the basis of race. But when you start bringing that concept into the realm of immigration and population, you're taking a concept that is a good concept and you're applying it in a situation where it doesn't make sense. You want to have a cohesive community. And that means that you should be bringing in people who you have more in common with, culturally, religiously, ethnically, linguistically, and in other ways. And you should be bringing them in and trying to assimilate them into your community. And the idea that it's racist to do that has really made us adopt a model of immigration and a model of multiculturalism, the salad bowl approach, that has led to worse outcomes. So that would be my reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, sort of people jumping to conclusions, which happens because the majority of crimes then committed by immigrants were committed by Muslim immigrants. You had the infamous tragic case of the Pakistani Muslim rape gangs that were ignored for decades. And that sort of jumped to people's minds when an event, another crime happens. Okay, it's just like these other crimes. So you get this assumption, and you had a lot of the protests that weren't, you know, that then took on the mantle of like all the previous crimes together. You have a situation, sort of a straw that breaks the camel's back, and that's what people come out and with rage against. And we saw this with some of the people who were jailed over online comments. I saw one, there was basically blasphemy laws being enforced in the UK, where one of the protesters who had shouted things about Allah, religiously offensive comments, and he was put in prison, jail sentence. And several other people on various other, tweets, retweets, posts on Facebook, saying that nothing that looked like, you would say it is even, we're even calls to violence, no, not even committing, calling people to commit crimes, but they were basically imprisoned in the UK because it's illegal to say things that might be considered hateful, that might make people feel unsafe, especially if it's towards, people of a minority group, as they call it. That's like the crime, they consider the speech crimes are worse if they're targeted at or aimed at people who belong to some kind of protected minority.
Yeah, so there's double standards there. But what's going on here is, so we've got these minority groups in the country. It's stirred up racial conflict. And now in an effort to manage the racial conflict that this bad policy has created, they want to try and tamp down racial tensions by passing hate speech laws. So the way to fix the problems caused by multiculturalism is to bring in a sort of authoritarian police state with, speech restrictions and all sorts of other restrictions in order to manage the ethnic conflict. Now, obviously, that's bad. Obviously, we don't want an authoritarian, Orwellian police state. We don't want to be living in that situation. We need to be able to talk about the problem to raise awareness that this is a bad policy, that this mass immigration and multiculturalism policy is a bad policy. And if we can't talk about it, then we don't really have a real democracy anymore. So
I was just thinking, this UK situation, when I've studied the origins of, say, Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew's approach, because he had a fairly authoritarian approach in Singapore, they had a similar origin in sort of Singapore that ended up coming out of ethnic strife, and there were race riots in Singapore, and he basically implemented, a strict regime there as well, in terms of people who would even try to proselytize other religions could be imprisoned if you said anything that could stir up emotions towards ethnic conflict. All those people were thrown into prison to kind of create Singapore and as a cohesive country, because he had all these different ethnic groups to work together. And he was successful, obviously, in doing that with a very kind of rigid right-wing authoritarian way that he ruled over that country and turned it into a proper country. The UK is like, they've sort of it's a similar thing where they have to now start putting people in prison because of these same things, but they're not doing it in a cohesive way, because they've created it's not like, oh, we've inherited a bad situation, we now have to fix it using harsh methods. It's a case of like the government has created the bad situation, and now the government is going to use harsh methods to supposedly try and fix it. But just like they created this terrible situation, they have no idea what they're doing, and so they're just going to make things worse.
Yes, and you have to remember that there are important cultural differences as well between Singapore and Britain. Britain is like the home of liberty, liberalism, free speech, Magna Carta. That's a big part of what it means to be British and what it means to be Anglo, is to be, to be saturated with, to have grown up with those other ideas. Give me liberty or give me death. And so you're going to have a much harder time doing it in Britain. And second of all, like, even if you were to succeed, you would have taken away something essential to the nature of British people in the British community. And that applies in Britain, but it also applies in all the diaspora communities, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the United States as well. There's something essential to our culture about liberty. And if the only way of managing the multicultural situation that has been created is to get rid of liberty, we're losing something important about ourselves and our culture and our way of life. And so that's why part of the reason why I object so strongly to it.
Yes, well, that's why, like I said, I was just thinking on the fly here, like, hey, someone has solved this problem before, but that's probably not the kind of solution that the people who are listening to this program or people who are make up the majority of the citizens of the United Kingdom or various other Anglo countries, like, this is not really the kind of solution that people want. Kind of sort of like, yes, the problem has been fixed before. let's not go there. We don't really want to go there. We don't want to get to the point where that's the solution. And speaking of like people being jailed for thought crimes or being harassed by the police for thought crimes, we just had another case a week ago in New Zealand. I think it was around the day that we aired the previous weekly roundup. We didn't have time to include it then, or it developed over the weekend. I can't quite remember, but there was a Twitter user by the name of Nobody, I think it was supposed to be the joke there. And he sent this in to a good friend of ours, Simon Anderson, who's very prolific in terms of covering cases and police abuse in Auckland City. And the police went around to his house and threatened him over his firearms license, saying that he'd been posting things online. You know, he had the 6 o'clock knock on the door, two police officers saying, hey, we'd like to talk to you about some of your posts on the internet. Would you like to tell us what you think about that, William?
Well, I don't think it's very positive.
Me in saying the police are still doing this. Like, we've highlighted so many of these cases over the years. We have a new government and the police are still going around and harassing people about online content, saying, no, it's nothing illegal. You haven't done anything wrong, but we'd still like to talk to you about it.
Yeah, so we've talked about the police hate speech training, and we were wondering how that's going to be used or rolled out in real life. And this has given us an example. So that the police are coming around to his house, they're saying, well, look, you haven't done anything criminal. We're not even accusing you of doing anything criminal. However, we have to check up about whether you're a fit and proper person to have a firearms license. And it just so happens that you've been making these funny tweets on the internet, and some people might consider them hateful. And if they were hateful, we might have to take that into consideration when we're thinking about whether you ought to have a firearms license. So you can sort of see the way these things are going to be weaponized. They're going to find all sorts of ways where, even though it's not technically a crime, it can be used to, it can be weaponized to hurt people, to get at them, to impose costs on them, to take away some of their liberties. And in that way, it's still going to have the desired effect. It still provides a disincentive to people to engage in so-called hateful behavior. And when what they're calling hateful is just really having the wrong opinions. It's being against immigration. It would be like saying a lot of the things I've said already in this conversation about thinking the multicultural salad bowl model is bad, and that the government's made bad policy decisions with mass immigration, and that the way to manage some of this ethnic conflict maybe not to have invited so many people into the country in the first place, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's extremely worrying. The police shouldn't be doing that. And this has come out of the recommendations of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the Christchurch terror attack, where they thought the best way to prevent future terror attacks like this is to bed in diversity, inclusion through all the public sector, and to also bed in sort of hate speech laws if possible. Now, they haven't got hate speech laws, but they're doing it in a different way. They're doing it in this way. And the idea is to tamp down the ethnic conflict in that way. I'm not sure that's going to have the desired effect. I think it may very well have the opposite effect to what is intended. It may, like, people will resent it, and it may flare up the conflict. And also, we shouldn't have to live in a sort of totalitarian, authoritarian sort of police state where we've got the police coming around doing these type of things.
Yeah, nobody wants to live in a society where the police is going to be knocking on your door because you said something, you know, you made an inappropriate joke on the internet or something, or opposed some government policy, and then you've got the police knocking on your door. You know, something that I experienced in 2020 was having the police raid my house because of some, you know, I'd objected to their legislation that they had had opposed, and I said, I think this is bad legislation. And then you get all kinds of horrible things done to you by the police when you haven't committed any crime whatsoever. They say, oh, we think you might commit a crime because you didn't like this legislation. This is the kind of way that the police have been treating a lot of people over the years. And just terrible to still see them doing it, you know, with a lighter touch now, it seems, but it's still the same thing, exactly the same thing happening.
What's interesting about it is that this is the argument that many on the left make about policing in minority communities. So they argue that, you know, the increased police presence in the minority communities, that, you know, the targeting of the, because that often that's where the crime happens, but addressing it by putting more police on the ground in the communities is what's causing the crime there. And so if they really believe that argument, you can see that there is sort of an intention to provoke violence and reaction in part of what they're doing. I think they would love, because for a long time, the problem that the proponents of immigration and multiculturalism have had is that, you know, they have all these Muslim terrorist attacks, these terror attacks by other groups, and it never really is the evil, dreaded white nationalists or white supremacists who are committing the terror attacks. And they would love nothing more for it to be sort of equal on both sides. If there are a lot of white terrorist attacks over here to balance out the Muslim terror attacks, and then they could say, oh, look, so it's not the immigrants that are really bad, everyone does it. And so if they could provoke some attacks on the other side by treating the, you know, the domestic white conservative right-wing population unfairly, that would serve them very well. They would love nothing more than that, I think.
Final thing on the subject of multiculturalism then. We saw this week a members bill put forward by the ACT Party's ethnic communities spokesperson, Parmjeet Parmar. She wanted to say that the police could take oaths on whatever holy book or text they desired. At the moment, at least officially, you can take an oath on the Bible, or you can make an affirmation in general without any religious connotation. Although I have seen some lawyers state that there are various loopholes where you can use whatever religious text you want. But of course, whatever her intention is here, maybe the ACT Party, liberalism, equality, everything has to be the same. She wants to enshrine in legislation, so basically saying that all religious texts are the same, or no matter if you're, you know, you can, she puts the Bible and the Sikh religious text and the Hindu one and the Muslim one all together in legislation.
Yeah, well, we can see here, this is a good example of the difference between a libertarian or liberal approach and a conservative approach. The liberal or libertarian wants to sort of try and remain neutral between all different positions, between all different value judgments, between all different, you know, religious traditions, moral views, etc. Whereas the conservative position is to protect one's own
heritage and faith.
Heritage, faith, culture, etc. And so if this bill was to go through, it would contribute to the fragmentation and the undermining of the traditional New Zealand culture, which is Christianity on the one hand, and there's also a number of atheists here now, and that's fine. And if this were to go through, we'd obviously have more sort of religious diversity, more religious fragmentation. And, you know, the lesson that really ought to be being drawn from what's happening in the UK and what's happening in other places is that it's that ethnic, religious, cultural, linguistic fragmentation of the community that drives the conflict. And this is the big difference between left and right. The people on the right think it's the diversity itself that drives the conflict, whereas the people on the left seem to believe it's your attitude to the diversity that drives the conflict. If only everyone adopted the good liberal attitude and didn't notice racial differences, then all the problems would go away. But I don't think they're right about that.
No, well, like, you know, the examples you're saying, if you put, say, and we've had this in New Zealand as well, and in Canada too, for instance, like differences between Sikhs and Hindus and Muslims, bringing their like conflict over from the countries that they come from. You know, what are you going to convince them to like embrace liberal neutrality and convince them to put aside their religious differences? while at the same time embracing multiculturalism and telling them that you're not going to require them to change their beliefs. Like, it's obviously incoherent to have the expectation that everyone's going to suddenly ignore the diversity, because everyone has essentially an exclusive truth claim, especially if you're religious. And if you, even if you're non-religious, you also in a sense have an exclusive claim to the truth. And you can't just, like, there's no possible way to have people just like put that aside and to have everybody hold hands together and pretend like they're all, you know, diverse together.
Questions of identity and questions of like conflict between different identity groups. It's one of those things that unless you don't notice your identity, you sort of take it for granted, unless it comes under threat. And the problem with diversity and multiculturalism is that the differences between these communities, they rub up against each other all the time. You have different groups wanting different things. You have competition through the political system to actualize them. And so people feel that their identity is under threat. And that's one of the main reasons why, at least, that the political conversation has moved more towards talking about identity all the time, because people within these diverse societies feel that their identity is under threat. And the reason they feel that way is because it kind of is.
And on that subject, we had a little bit of an update from Stats New Zealand about people who are leaving New Zealand. So we've obviously spoken about the immigration numbers whenever they come up on the weekly roundup. There was not really a big update, I think, in this release from Stats New Zealand. But the main thing that really struck me was how many young people are leaving the country, which is another really bad sign. I mean, that's just a terrible sign for the country. But if young people are sort of leaving, it means they feel like there's no real future here. Or if you were just talking about their identity, for instance, their belief in the country is evaporated, or it just doesn't exist. And off they go, and they look for better opportunities overseas, and hope that maybe they'll find what they're looking for out there in the great big world.
Well, you didn't mention the magic words, the great replacement update.
Sorry, I should have done that. were there big changes to the numbers? I believe the net the overall numbers are down, right? But the net numbers are still quite high on both sides.
Yeah, they didn't. The little document that Stats produced didn't have the month by month figures, which is disappointing, because what it shows is that the year to June or July figures, they're coming down. So the it's still high. 200,000 people came in, 130,000 left, for a 73,000 gain on net, and 55,000 Kiwis left.
There was 80,000 Kiwis left, I saw.
How much, sorry?
80,000.
I had 55,000 in my numbers, but that's maybe there's a difference between the net and the gross figure there, which there sometimes is, because the Kiwis come back as well.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, I'm looking at the net figures. Yeah, okay, you'll have the gross figures in terms of 50,000, yeah.
but yeah, there's still near record numbers of Kiwis leaving. The 200,000 total people coming in is down from a peak of like 250,000, yeah, something like that. So it's coming down gradually. So maybe some things the government have done have started to move the needle in terms of the number of immigrants coming into the country. We still want to see the trend continue over the coming months. But it looks like there are positive signs in terms of the numbers coming in, although it's still high. But yeah, the number of Kiwis leaving now is problematic. And really the only way to fix that, I think, is to get the economy going again. So there's good high paying jobs here to get people to stay. That would be the main way of fixing that.
And on the economy, then, what are your views from the week, basically the news that we've had this week? How we just had an OCR cut, reduction of the official cash rate from 5.5% to 5.25%. Which basically means, when that flows through to borrowing, it means that your mortgages will become slightly cheaper when you try to refix those potentially. We've had tax cuts come in from the National Party coalition agreement as well. Small numbers of small extra cash in your pocket if you're working. And also they did increase the tax credits as well, the Working for Families tax credits. But there are also other problems like energy crisis. Energy prices are going up. We're just not hitting demand there. We're still running low on natural gas, which is going to take, 10 years to fix. There have been some changes to welfare announced as well. I don't know how that's going to impact the economy. What's your overall view on, there's a whole bunch of changes that have been announced in the past week, but what does the economy look like as a whole to you? Do things look good? Because the Reserve Bank is basically saying they expect things to be quite lackluster in the next year.
Well, I think the big thing that's happened here is that the huge inflation that happened under the last Labor government during COVID, when they printed a lot of money and spent a lot of money, has finally basically come back under control. And so the Reserve Bank has decided that because of that, because the inflation is now back under control, and also because the economy looks like we're in a slowdown and unemployment is starting to rise, they've decided to cut interest rates, which is to be expected. So interest rate cuts, generally stimulatory to the economy, probably won't have a big enough effect immediately to really turn things around in a big way.
A lag of like a year at least on those before they really impact the economy, I believe.
Yeah, everything takes time. But it's a good thing. I think this gradually, this should help the economy to grow again. The energy crisis is really, that's caused by shortage of water in the hydro lakes, coupled with the fact that we don't have alternative fuel sources as much as we ought to have for when those hydro levels are low. We don't have large amounts of natural gas. Some of our other, coal-fired power plants and other things like this, we don't have alternatives. And so Shane Jones has been quite big on this issue. The ACT Party have said some good things. Simon Court wants to get a cross-party agreement on exploiting natural gas. Because the problem there is there's uncertainty in the market. Because people think, well, there's no point really investing in getting some natural gas out of the ground if the Labor Party is going to come in and torpedo it when they get into power because of climate change goals or net zero or other environmental concerns. So this is this problem of worrying about investment certainty again, and that's the same problem with mining as well and many other things.
And they're threatening charter schools as well. Obviously, that seems to be going ahead. Kind of it's a small-scale local thing, but the Labor Party is continuing to threaten all of these things, saying that they're going to demolish them the second they get back into power, which is a bit of a problem for the economy, for parents and families and education and when it comes to jobs and economic growth. So, There's a way to avoid that, though, right? Like the Labour Party threatening to sabotage all of these things. That's kind of their job, isn't it?
Well, kind of. I mean, they're wielding power in an effective way, given what their agenda is. The only way I can think of to really combat that is you have to threaten something that they care about in the same way, and then negotiate with them to say, well, look, if you let us have the natural gas, then we won't tank your thing. That's how, there's got to be something like that you do. Otherwise,
aggressive negotiation.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, they're just going to wield this, unless you combat them in some way, they're just going to continue to wield this power to create the risk in the markets so that these initiatives that they're against for environmental reasons can never go ahead.
And speaking of sort of weaponized things, we have seen some ads placed by Hobson's Pledge in New Zealand Herald, and that caused a lot of angst, a lot of upset voices from the Maori Party in particular, and others connected with the Labour Party as well, I believe, and in academic circles, in the media itself, and that resulted in NZME pulling all ads from Hobson's Pledge, saying, no, we were no longer running any ads. They had a bunch scheduled to go ahead in the coming weeks and months. And this has to do with the foreshore and seabed ruling by one of the courts, basically saying that the foreshore and seabed, could be claimed by certain iwi under certain conditions. And the government has already announced, I believe, they're going to be amending that legislation anyway. But that's the there seems to be a big all-out war between Hobson's Pledge and the Maori Party, and you know, that's gotten into the point now where a struggling media organization is refusing ads from Hobson's Pledge.
Yeah, well, this is an example of the thugs beta, right? It's where you kick up such a fuss and yell and scream and threaten people so that the thing they can't say the thing that they want to say. And in this case, they've provided, by calling people racists and acting in a sort of generally aggressive kind of manner, they've intimidated, or they've set up a series of costs or risks that the New Zealand Herald have to think about when they're running these ads. And they've made the decision, which is sort of rational in a way, to not run the ads. But ideally, that's a problem for free speech. If people can't run ads, if people can't, you know, pay a media provider to put a front page ad in because people are willing to kick up a fuss and threaten them and call them racist and things like that. So it's a problem for free speech. We need to speak out against that sort of behavior. And ideally, you ought to be able to run ads in a free society.
A lot of the complaints came around issues of misinformation. They claim that what Hobson's Pledge was advertising was factually incorrect or deceiving and misleading in some way. But that all really does seem to be a matter of opinion, doesn't it? I'm not sure if you have any views about the particular wording or the particular complaints. But to me, not being an issue that I care about too much, although I might get a lot of comments, a lot of emails sent in from listeners to tell me why I should really care about it. But if I'm trying to be a little bit impartial as an observer here, I don't fully, I don't fully see the reason for the accusations, unless, like, it's sort of almost seems to be like the Maori Party are acting like it's an existential threat, like it's an attack on their existence, which seems a little bit extreme to me for something that the government has already pledged it's going to take away. Like it's already going to pass legislation to reverse this court ruling. And so Hobson's Pledge is almost, when I first saw it, I thought, well, Hobson's Pledge is just wasting their money because the government's going to fix it anyway. But perhaps I'm misunderstanding what Hobson's Pledge is calling for as well. And perhaps they want the government to do more than what the government's suggested.
Perhaps they do, yeah. I mean, what the government is saying is that the legislation that they would pass would allow around 10% of the coastline to still be contested in the courts and aim to protect around 90% of it for Kiwis. So there's still 10% of the coastline, still a significant amount.
And that's significant enough for Hobson's Pledge to obviously put out the ad and to do the campaign that they're doing. Yep.
Yeah. And there's a number of different arguments that you can run about whether anyone should own or have customary rights, or especially exclusive customary rights around the foreshore and seabed at all. I mean, in the Helen Clark years, I think they ran with the idea that the foreshore and the seabed, the beaches, they should be for all Kiwis. And I think that most Kiwis sort of instinctively would feel that something like that is the correct solution.
Certainly. And I can understand to some extent the claim that some tribes might have about beaches and foreshore and seabed that, you know, they that, you know, their ancestors fished and effectively that they owned in times gone by. But obviously the standard common law approach and perhaps even in statute has been the fact that sort of the coastline belongs to the crown, right? The king owns the beaches and everyone gets to use it. And that's the traditional English approach.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a good approach. But I'm also, I take claims of customary title seriously as well. I mean, if there is a, you know, a continuous, long-standing use that, you know, an iwi or, you know, a hapu has used for a food source or for, you know, traditional fishing or whatever, then that, I think it's appropriate for courts to take that sort of thing seriously. It's just that what was proposed is that even tenuous sort of links or occasional usage that wasn't continued, it would basically put the whole foreshore and seabed up to be, you know, to be debated in the courts.
And that's natural for people to, like, if you give people an opening, they're going to take it. You can't really blame them for taking the opportunity. And it's really a problem with the government. Well, a problem for the government to solve, to say, no, these are the rules, and these are the rules that everyone is going to play by, and we're not going to leave things open in an ambiguous way for people to exploit, because then you're actually incentivizing people to exploit that ambiguity.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the gravy train argument.
Right? Exactly. And that's created a lot of tension in New Zealand politics. It's created a lot of unnecessary strife. And we don't really seem to have an end. Like, it just seems to be getting worse to me. I think that the Māori Party, look at the polling numbers, the Māori Party is doing incredibly well out of this as well. It's a point I think worth making as well, is that both, like, Hobson's Pledge and the Māori Party are like perfect enemies. They feed off each other. They're like a yin-yang kind of two sides to the coin, where they both grow stronger as this issue is more live. Like, the longer it lives for, the more ambiguous it becomes, the stronger these forces become, and the more emboldened and empowered they become. And I don't mean that negatively towards either of them, because, you know, it's a big issue. And it's almost strange. It is strange to me that sort of the center of politics, like National and Labour, they're so similar on so many issues. The Labour Party is obviously, as we've just said, like Helen Clark stabbed them in the back on the foreshore and seabed in the past. But it's sort of the central part of the center of politics hasn't dealt with this issue in a decisive way, because it really does open things up for, you know, the quote unquote fringes, so kind of like the outside elements of politics to really make a really big fight out of this issue. And the longer it's around, the more existential it becomes, as I've said, because it's like a winner takes all situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we've seen, the way structurally a lot of this thing can happen is that you create an industry, right? And there's a number of people who are in organizations, they have paid jobs, they work in the treaty industry. We see the same thing in the US. There's a number of people who work in the diversity industry and the civil rights industry. There's large organizations there. They have mailing lists. They have donors. These are big institutions with a lot of power in politics. And once those institutions get set up, they want to continue to exist, because people want to keep their jobs. People are committed to the cause. They want to keep doing what they're doing.
Enough voters to affect the outcome.
Yeah. So there's an incentive to create conflict and to keep these issues relevant, even when they're not really, to sort of blow it up, because it keeps them in the news, it keeps the donations coming, etc. And I think most Kiwis, what they really want with these treaty settlements is that most Kiwis want genuine grievances to be settled. They want the wrongs of the past to be put right, but they want it to come to an end after that is done and for us to move forward together. And the problem is, for that to happen, it means that the grievance industry, these organizations, these people with these jobs, that all has to come to an end. And that's a very tough thing. It's hard to make that happen. It's not easy. It's not as easy as simply having a vote on it in one election.
Yeah,
it's really a structural thing.
Yeah, and it's not something that, say, I was just asking about the political center, but it's not something the political center is willing to commit to putting a stop to. Somebody who's squishy, say like Christopher Luxon, he doesn't have the spine or the stomach to put something like that to an end. You're never going to probably see that from a Labour Party leader either, at least not for a long way to come, unless this issue starts to cause serious harm to the chances of winning elections, which is why, and I wrote about this recently, I think kind of the left has to really think about how they're going to win the elections, probably not next time, but the time after that, or the one, you know, 6 years from now. They're going to have very serious strategic decision-making on how they're actually going to win. And interestingly enough, you may actually have to have a Labour Party leader who puts an end to this, and sort of in the way that, like I said, they felt like Helen Clark stabbed in the back. Perhaps she made it worse, but it's going to have to be someone tough quote unquote, to like Helen Clark, to kind of potentially put an end to this. So that's very interesting theory I'm coming up with here. I'll have to think about that and develop it a little bit, but I appreciate your insights on it, because it's a good thing to keep in mind, that these bureaucratic organizations that get set up to solve a particular problem can never solve the problem, because then their entire reason for existing disappears. And it's very hard to get people to put themselves out of a job.
That's it. Yep.
Well, that's about it for me from the roundup this week. Thank you very much for joining me. The last few weeks, I've forgotten to remind people how to find you and follow your work, your excellent work on X. That's The Zeitgeist, William McGimsey on X, and you'll find him there. And you can find me there as well at Bright Minds NZ, Dewa De Boer. Always great to be in touch with the audience here, the listeners, the emails you write in, the text messages you send. I appreciate all of it. And, we try and respond directly when you do send feedback about the weekly roundup. So enjoy interacting with you guys and gals who are listening.
Me too.
All right. Well, that is it for this week. I will be back after the break, so stick around. And to William, we will see you next week.
All right. See you, Dewa.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.